Well, welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm Richard Bennett, and today I'm going to speak with Peter Rasavi, who's the president and founder of Rasavi Research, a consulting firm that works in the wireless space and has for some 20 years with leading companies on technologies and standards that we use every day in our lives on the wireless network. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Well, I'm really glad to have you. You and I have worked together a little bit in the past. You've written pieces for High Tech Forum that I think you wrote a piece on the value of low band and high band spectrum a few years ago that is still the most visited piece on the blog. So you're always good for traffic, if nothing else.
Thanks, Richard. Yes, that question of low band versus high band remains today, but it is interesting what the valuations were for the AWS spectrum, which really vindicated my theory that the emphasis is increasingly going to be on higher bands for capacity versus low bands for coverage.
Yeah, that's really playing out. Last week, the Senate Commerce Committee passed the Mobile Now Act in executive session, but only after a lot of wrangling to ensure that the as much low-band spectrum as possible could be added to the pot. It's the bill essentially doubled or tripled the total quantity of spectrum that's available to operators, but a lot of it was in the millimeter wave bands that don't really have the same propagation characteristics as the low-frequency bands, and so they have that coverage dilemma.
Yes, and the millimeter wave bands are getting a lot of attention, as they should, because I think they will represent the means for vastly more capacity in the future, but we should not forget about the sub 6 gigahertz area, because that is going to remain for a long time equally important.
Well, and that takes us segues right into the first thing I wanted to bring up. You've just come back from the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, where I wasn't there, but the press coverage all indicated that 5G was the whole buzz of what's going on in Mobile World Congress. Is that pretty much the way you saw it?
Yes, absolutely. 5G received a tremendous amount of attention at Mobile World Congress. It was exciting to see actual demonstrations of 5G pre-standard systems, obviously, since the standards are not yet complete. But for example, Ericsson had a demonstration of 5G where they had aggregate throughput of over 20 gigabits per second, and they were able to show dynamic beamforming across two different beams and maintaining these very high data rates. So yes, a lot of work has occurred, and the show certainly emphasized a lot of vendors' efforts in this area.
Well, I think this is something that the general public is maybe a little confused about on a couple of different points. And the first one is, really, what is 5G? I mean, we're aware that mobile communication standards have evolved from the analog systems that some people call 1G. They weren't really called that at the time. It was just, you know, cell phones. To 2G, which was the first digital implementation. Then on to 3G, which was very similar to 2G, but it radically increased the data rates for the mobile broadband portion of it from essentially a few kilobits per second to, one or two megabits in really ideal conditions, and probably something more on the order of 350 kilobits typically. Then we went on to 4G and got into megabits, healthy set of megabits, but there was also a re-architecting of the system in that 4G is also encompassed LTE, which was a reformulation of the way the technical elements of the system put together such that Internet Protocol became a central part. And now going
That's
on
exactly
to 5G,
correct. Yes.
How would you characterize what 5G has to offer to the consumer of wireless devices and networks?
From a consumer point of view, what consumers will experience with 5G is the most obvious thing will be dramatically higher throughputs. But to some extent, 4G LTE already provides very high throughput rates in excess of 10 megabits per second, and people frequently measure tens of megabits per second.
Especially in small countries and in Korea and Japan, we see reports coming in that speeds are sometimes on the order of 50 to 60 megabits per second.
Right, exactly. So if you are streaming video in high definition on Netflix, for example, then really 5 megabits is all you need for an application like that. So you might ask, well, what will I get for all that extra throughput? Well, you know, enhanced ultra high definition will become possible, but I think to some extent the throughputs will not necessarily be the major factors consumers will see. The other side of these really high throughputs and the use of more spectrum, especially in millimeter wave, is that the networks will have hugely more capacity. So to the extent that mobile broadband can be a wireline replacement today, right now it's a wireline replacement only for a small percentage of people, something in the 10 to 15% range is what I read recently. Mm-hmm. With 5G, now you have a network connection that only provides the broadband capabilities, but the capacity will be so much greater that I think you'll see a much larger percentage of people cutting the cord for broadband and being able to just use their wireless connection. So that's one thing consumers will see. But another major aspect is that the network from the ground up is being designed to accommodate the Internet of Things, which means being able to very efficiently communicate small payloads, to have very high battery life. And so you'll see a much larger number of use cases for the technology compared to 4G. And I think that is probably the more important aspect of 5G. 5G will be able to support a much larger range of applications. So it will permeate our entire lives and economy to a much greater extent than 4G has.
Well, it becomes fairly clear when we look at the use cases for 5G. And I went to a seminar on 5G that was in conjunction with a meeting of one of the standards bodies in North American standards bodies several months ago, in which an awful lot of the discussion, frankly, to my surprise, was focused on these use cases. And like you said, the use cases span a really incredibly broad range, everything from fairly low data rate, very power sensitive Internet of Things devices, all the way up to ultra high definition television, and then beyond that, I think into virtual reality and augmented reality kinds of applications, in which the data rates for some of those applications in their full and mature form really could push a gigabit per second per user. So it's not, you know, when you say the demonstration you saw in Barcelona was 20 gigabits. These are going to be speeds that we're all pretty comfortable with and consider as, you know, pretty ordinary in the years to come, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the march of throughput will continue for the foreseeable future with no end in sight, because even though we can only imagine some applications that require that much bandwidth, as you mentioned, augmented reality and virtual reality and ultra high definition, there will be applications that we cannot even imagine. So as soon as you give developers and entrepreneurs the innovators, that bandwidth, they will find creative ways to use it. They always have, and they always will.
Well, and you know, there are applications already that could use that kind of bandwidth, maybe not continuously, but on an occasional basis. If you have security, video security cameras around your property, and an event takes place that causes those cameras to all trigger an alarm, you can require a fairly significant amount of bandwidth for a short period of time if you've got four or five cameras that are all streaming video outside the property.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so I think one of the implications of to explain something you said to the consumer, the ability of these networks to support mobile broadband speeds for a large number of customers, the way that translates into your monthly bill is that the data limits are probably going to increase quite dramatically. So the carriers, I think, tend to, most popular data plans are probably around 10 gigabytes per month, and which is, you know, not enough to do Netflix streaming every night for 4 or 5 hours. But as the network becomes intrinsically faster, then, you know, when it's up into the gigabit range, even if no individual user is taking advantage of the full gigabit or 10 gigabits or 20 gigabits, it means the network has the ability to support multiple users at the same time. So one of the implications of that would be probably higher data limits, right?
Yes, absolutely. When I started consulting in wireless data, the up-and-coming technology was cellular digital packet data, CDP.
Oh, yeah, I worked on that.
Right. Yeah. And the effective throughput rate was 10 kilobits per second, and the usage based plans on that were 10 cents per kilobyte, mm-hmm. which doesn't sound like very much, but it actually translates to $100,000 per gigabyte. Mm-hmm. And today we're paying, you know, on the usage based plans somewhere around $10 a gigabyte. So that trend is going to continue, and I don't want to forecast exactly what a gigabyte of data will cost 10 years from now, but I do expect it to be significantly lower. Right now, the way it manifests itself is that you can cut the cord to your TV and just stream your video through Netflix and Amazon Prime and Hulu and so forth, and you can cut your cord to your broadband and just go with a wireless connection, but you cannot do both.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So 10 years from now, you may, or maybe 5 years from now, you may be able to cut the cord to both. And that will be a significant change in how we consume entertainment and broadband.
Well, one of the things I study is international broadband speeds to get a handle on, you know, how different countries stack up in terms of the innovation environment they create. And one of the odd pieces of data that I've found in that research is evidence that in the countries that have the highest broadband speeds because they have fully deployed fiber optic networks, you know, to all the residences and in fact, where most people live in apartments in high-rise buildings, there's more cord cutting in nations like Korea, Japan, and Hong Kong and Singapore than we find in countries where the peak broadband capacities are much lower. And I think it's a consequence. It's usually attributed to, you know, young people who grow up communicating with each other through their mobile devices. And when the mobile devices, you know, hit the kind of speeds that they can hit in those countries because of the extensive infrastructure and lots of spectrum available, there's just no need for a second device. And of course, you know, millennials, they're not as big on watching TV on big screens as us older people are.
Right. Yes, exactly. Well, some of those countries have much higher densities of population, and it changes the economics of deploying networks. The networks don't have to cover as great a geographic area as we mm-hmm. have in the United States. And I think it does allow operators to achieve greater efficiencies as far as dollars per, you know, bit per second per square meter.
Oh, yeah, the infrastructure costs really, they radically decline. It costs anywhere from 5 to 10 times as much to connect a home to fiber in the U.S. as it does in Hong Kong.
Interesting.
Yeah, I got some data. I mean, because, you know, what you're doing basically in Hong Kong, everybody lives in a high-rise building. So the carrier just brings the fiber into the basement of the building, and the rest of it, even if the rest of the wiring in that building is copper, the distance is so short that, you know, you get incredibly high speeds throughout the building, and it, you're just making that one connection and then, you know, going into a patch panel and bringing the telephone wires over. And then in the fullness of time, they replace the copper phone lines with fiber just as part of the maintenance cycle for the building. And, you know, lo and behold, everybody has enough capacity, at least at the cable plant level, to, you know, last 20, 30 years, if not longer.
Right. Yeah, so I think 5G will change the economics for broadband deployment or density of broadband, because two things will really drive 5G capacity. One is access to up to 10 times as much spectrum as we have right now. The amount of spectrum available in the millimeter wave, beginning at 28 gigahertz and going on to 37, 39, and the even higher frequencies that are being contemplated, there's just a lot more spectrum there. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not a slam dunk. Using those higher frequencies does require some fairly advanced radio methods, but the trials occurring are very promising, but the cells that will be used for 5G will be very small. They will be, you know, they will be small cells with maybe a range of 100 to a couple of hundred meters at the most. But that actually itself will then provide tremendous capacity gain, because you'll be able to reuse those frequencies over very short distances. So it's really that combination of a lot of small cells. I heard Verizon say yesterday in a public webcast that they contemplated, you know, 6 to 8 times as many small cells as macro cells, not necessarily for their network, but just
overall
in the 5G context. So you multiply that gain with 10 times as much spectrum, with maybe, you know, further increases in spectral efficiency because the technology is more advanced. And that's how you end up with these huge gains in capacity.
Well, and the spectral efficiencies are things like beamforming, new forms of coding that enable us to get more bits per second per hertz, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yes, yes. And one of the complementary technologies is something called massive MIMO. Mm-hmm. MIMO standing for multiple input, multiple output. The idea is that you have multiple antennas on the transmit side, multiple antennas on the receive side. That gives you two benefits. One is that you can rely on the signal propagating through the environment in different ways, bouncing off one building here, another building there for another path. That gives you something called spatial multiplexing, effectively parallel transmission through the environment. But then the other benefit with all those extra antennas is that you can do the beamforming, as you mentioned, and that provides additional gains as well.
So beamforming is something that makes radio waves behave more like wires, right?
Virtual wires through the environment.
Yeah, because the waves can cross each other. It's not a problem when the waves cross each other. They don't cancel each other out. It's when you have multiple waves striking a receiver at the same time that you have an interference issue.
Right, yes.
And that becomes a whole lot easier in the higher frequencies, because those signals don't tend to... It's a lot easier to design antennas that prevent those signals from spreading so much.
Well, the big advantage is that your antenna size and antenna spacing, if you want to have multiple antennas, that those have to be sized and spaced according to
the wavelength
of the signal. And as your frequencies go up, then the wavelengths go down, and suddenly, instead of having to have antennas that are inches or tens of inches apart, they only have to be, you know, a few millimeters apart. So you can design these huge antenna arrays that occupy only a small amount of area.
And so those things can be etched onto, essentially etched onto circuit boards, such that they fit inside a laptop or inside your smartphone very conveniently, and you have, instead of one, or what's kind of common in mobile devices now is that have MIMO, is maybe two antennas in a handset. You know, you can have 16, 32, 64.
Right, exactly. And that's one reason, and I don't think this story has been fully told, but that's one reason that even the AWS frequencies beginning at 1.7 gigahertz and then continuing up from there, you can do 4x4 MIMOs. You can put in four antennas into a device at 1.7 gigahertz. Whereas the beachfront spectrum that we used to talk about,
that never was,
at 600, 700 megahertz, you cannot put in four antennas. At most, you can do two, right? So that's one reason that these higher frequencies are so much better suited for capacity.
Well, that doesn't really bode well for the incentive auction that's in the 600 megahertz range, does it?
It will be interesting to see how much people spend on that auction, but if you take an operator that already has a coverage solution, already has some frequencies available for coverage, their problem right now is capacity, not coverage. Mm-hmm. So the low frequencies will always play a part for coverage, but they are not the capacity solution that most people are focused on today. Spectrum is spectrum, though, so yeah. I don't think people will walk away from the auction. I think there will be healthy participation, but that spectrum might not turn out to be as valuable as some people had originally estimated.
Yeah, I mean, my guess on that would be that for the two carriers that have really good have fairly good inventories of low frequency spectrum for Verizon and AT&T, their incentive to participate that is probably going to be kind of a market by market. There may be some areas where they could use a little more, but on a nationwide basis, they're not going to be major. They're not going to be willing to pay majorly high prices for that. But, and the auction was sort of targeted, I think, at T-Mobile and Sprint. Sprint hasn't participated in an auction in as long as I can remember. So it should be probably T-Mobile and maybe Dish, which is potentially building a competitive network. I mean, they may actually make an acquisition run at Sprint. Who knows?
Right. Well, one additional way that those frequencies could be used is as a 5G underlay network. You saw that with LTE, that original deployments were at 700 megahertz just to be able to roll out the network very quickly and provide coverage everywhere. And then using carrier aggregation, the operators then deployed for capacity in higher bands such as AWS and other frequencies. And then we'll also be seeing refarming of the PCS frequencies. That's already happening in parts of the world. So a similar situation could potentially occur with the 600 megahertz frequencies. It would give operators clean spectrum to be able to do 5G, but whether they do or not remains to be seen. That really is a hypothetical deployment scenario at this stage.
Well, but the part of it that's not hypothetical is something you alluded to in the beginning, which is carrier aggregation, which is, I think, one of the key elements of 5G, right? The people want to have the ability to construct more or less a single data stream from the transactional standpoint out of multiple radio bands and essentially bond different radio bands together into a single data stream through carrier aggregation. And there's an awful lot of work being done in the 3GPP radio access network standards to make carrier aggregation more practical?
Yes, carrier aggregation is truly one of the great technical achievements of LTE, and that's really the major feature of LTE Advanced over LTE. There are other features, but that one has proven dramatically powerful because it does allow you to combine radio channels in the same band and in completely different bands to create these aggregated channels with much higher capacity, and you get much higher efficiencies. Carrier aggregation is also the basis for, you know, LTEU, LTE license-assisted access, and I think it will be a foundational element for 5G, because what you'll see in early 5G deployments, especially if you want to do millimeter wave or higher frequencies, is that it will be very difficult to get continuous coverage at those higher frequencies over large areas. So the lower frequencies will provide your constant connection. And then as you fall into these little islands of super high capacity, those will be aggregated to your base carrier to provide your much higher performance.
Oh, it's like when there's street racing.
It'll be like the magic glue to make that work.
Yes, it's like when they're street racing in Fast and Furious, they kick in the nitro.
Yeah, exactly.
As you get a little turbocharge when you're close to one of these small cells within that magic 100-foot radius or so.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really another aspect of 5G, is that it's going to be a very flexible, dynamic network. Mm-hmm. Your devices will be able to just have continuous coverage, and then as there are opportunities to operate on a faster basis through other bands, and it could be licensed, it could be unlicensed, could be 4G, could be 5G, it'll all combine to provide a much better user experience.
Okay, we're going to stop here for this episode of the High Tech Forum podcast and resume the conversation with Peter Rasavi on 5G in our next episode. If you enjoyed this podcast, go to iTunes and give us a rating, and if you really liked it, give us a review. And if you'd like to discuss what you've heard here, you can do that on the hightechforum.org blog, spelled just like it sounds. We'll be back soon with another podcast for your listening pleasure. If there's someone in particular you'd like to hear, drop us a note at our email address, info@hightechforum.org, and we'll see what we can do. So once again, thanks for listening, and be excellent to each other.